cases of the coronavirus in the U.S. The patient is one of several hundred people evacuated from China by the U.S. government and held in federally mandated quarantine at a military base in Southern California. Separately, China is now reporting it has confirmed more than 43,000 cases of coronavirus and more than 1,000 people have died. NPR is reporting exclusively today the nation's two largest educator unions are recommending that schools reconsider involving children in active shooter drills. NPR's Anya Kamenetz reports there's a growing concern these can traumatize children.
About 95% of American public schools conduct active shooter or lockdown drills, but there's little proof these drills are effective. And a new report from American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association, along with the group Everytown for Gun Safety, lays out the emerging evidence that active shooter drills are causing anxiety, sleeplessness, and other signs of trauma in children. For these reasons, the groups do not recommend that schools involve students in these exercises. And if a school does choose to hold these drills, the report says, they should always be announced and they should not include simulated violence. Anya Kamenetz, NPR News.
A series of strong storms is pouring heavy rain on parts of the South today. Parts of Alabama got 4 inches of rain on Monday. The region will receive more today. National Weather Service meteorologist Nathan Owen says that there is also a risk of damaging storms.
The tornado threat looks like it's diminishing a little bit, but we can't fully rule out a brief tornado across the area, mainly in the western two-thirds of, Alabama.
The National Weather Service says the threat will persist through tomorrow night, especially from the Tennessee Valley to the Gulf Coast. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 85 points at 29,362. The Nasdaq is down 46 points at 9,675. This is NPR. A federal judge has cleared the way for two major cell phone providers to merge. T-Mobile is seeking to take over rival Sprint in a deal worth $26.5 billion. Several states are objecting. They say consumers will see higher phone bills because competition will be less. The founder of the Grammy Award-winning group Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Joseph Shabalala, has died in South Africa. Ish Mafundukwa reports that he was 78 years old.
Shabalala and his group were already very popular in Southern Africa before their 1986 collaboration with Paul Simon on his multi-million selling album Graceland thrust them into global fame. They eventually won 5 Grammys on their own. They were also nominated 5 times. Ladysmith and Black Mambazo are among the leading exponents of the Zulu a cappella singing styles known as Mbube and Isicathamiya. Though Shabalala retired in 2014, the group is still recording and touring. For NPR News, I'm Ishma Fundikwa in Harare.
A suicide bomber in Afghanistan has killed at least 6 people today. This occurred near a military academy in the capital, Kabul. No one has claimed responsibility for the bombing attack that killed 2 civilians and 4 Afghan military personnel. Another 12 people have been injured. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in January released a plan to reduce federal government regulations protecting streams and wetlands. Proponents say the rule change will increase clarity and restore private property rights. Opponents worry about how the loss of federal protections could affect the nation's streams and wetlands going forward. Washington Post reporter Juliet Eilprin has been covering environmental regulations under the Trump administration. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ann.
What at its heart does the Trump administration want to change about the regulations?
The administration has worked to really pull back federal oversight on streams and wetlands across the country on the grounds that they argue that the previous administration, the Obama administration, really engaged in kind of federal overreach, that by providing so much federal oversight over these waterways, they not only were duplicative because the states were overseeing some of that, but also that it simply wasn't appropriate, that they were posing an impediment, an obstacle to whether it was development, farm operations, golf courses, and that it simply wasn't appropriate in keeping with the underlying law.
Does this move by the Trump administration just put us back to pre-Obama era levels, I guess, of regulation?
No, it actually goes further than that, although it is a little difficult to get precise figures. For example, the Environmental Protection Agency will not specifically say, you know, in terms of the Obama administration had estimated that, you know, 60% of the nation's waters were covered under the previous rule, and the EPA will not say right now how much they've curtailed it. It's significant. It could be roughly half. But they have gone further than even just stripping what the Obama administration did by, for example, eliminating the need for farmers to get case-by-case approvals, permits, from the federal government. And so there are ways in which this does go further than just negating what the Obama administration did.
But the Trump administration is saying that this is providing clarity.
Well, it is without question there has been significant confusion over what
okay.
the government should do. So I will say I have been covering this for a long time, and I think people are still confused over this. So it's hard to say that we now have clarity, but this dates back decades that there have been multiple Supreme Court cases on it. There's just been a great deal of debate about what constitutes a quote-unquote waters of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking today about plans by the EPA to revise how the federal government regulates streams and wetlands in the United States. Proponents have said the rule change increases clarity and restores private property rights. Environmentalists worry about the many streams and wetlands that could lose federal protections. My guest right now is Juliet Eilprin. She's a reporter for The Washington Post. As she said, she's been covering this for a long time. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. The erosion of the protections started almost immediately, didn't it, when he took office?
Yes. Scott Pruitt, there are a couple of different measures, but essentially, first, the president himself signed an executive order instructing EPA to roll back this regulation, and then Scott Pruitt, who at the time headed EPA, immediately began the process of suspending the rule and working to craft a substitute.
There have also been cuts in funding, at least in the last couple proposed budgets by the Trump administration, including the one that was proposed yesterday. It would cut, I think, almost one out of every $4 to the Environmental Protection Agency and Health and Human Services, for that matter. What's the implications of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, of course, we always feel obligated to cover these budget proposals. And, you know, the administration has been trying to make deep, deep cuts in EPA since it took office. Just for a point of comparison, in President Trump's first budget, they argued for a 31% cut that would have erased more than 20% of the agency's entire workforce. And none of these proposals have been enacted. Still, it is worth noting that these send a signal when the president is proposing very deep cuts to EPA, among the deepest cuts that the president proposed to any major agency.
Uh-huh.
That obviously sends a signal in terms of how they view that institution, and of course it sends a message to the employees who work there.
How has Congress reacted to these changes, these rule changes at the agency level?
Well, so in terms of, depending on whether you're talking about, you know, rules changes or budget cuts, EPA's proposed budget cuts have not gone into effect, and there's been a lot of pushback from members of Congress of both parties, in part because they see the role that EPA plays in their districts and in their states. In terms of the rules changes, you know, while obviously Democrats decry it, there is significant support every time, for example, the EPA and Army Corps of Engineers do a press event of the latest, you know, installment in now what is a final rule. They have a huge number of lawmakers, all Republicans, who stand up and hail these proposals as a step forward.
Besides lawmakers, who out there in the private sector is for this?
There's a considerable amount of support from industry groups. That includes everyone from farmers, the American Farm Bureau, the National Association of Home Builders. You know, there's just a huge number of, for example, you know, folks who are interested in having fewer federal restrictions on whether it's what kind of pesticides they can apply on their crops near a stream or what sort of digging and development they can do. And so there is considerable support, which is why the president hailed this at a meeting of the Farm Bureau. And then EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler went to a home builders convention in Las Vegas to talk about how he was delivering for developers.
Right. I thought that was very telling that he announced it there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That was absolutely part of the message that the administration wanted to send.
I don't know. I mean, we know a lot more about what's going on in the State Department these days. What's going on in the EPA? I mean, how have people within the agency responded to these changes?
Well, you know, there's obviously a very active debate on this. So, including among not just some of the employees who currently work in the agency, but their outside independent scientific advisors. So, as you alluded to earlier, what one thing that is very significant that I reported on just a few weeks ago is that EPA has a scientific advisory board, which is mandated by Congress and is supposed to give independent advice. And they said that this proposal, in the words of the scientists, neglects established science showing that if you contaminate groundwater, in wetlands and waterways, that can spread to drinking water supplies. So that is, obviously a significant criticism.
And how do they respond to that criticism?
The administration, when I asked about this, simply said that, they take into account, what they hear, but also that they were reflecting the legal limits imposed by the law and Supreme Court rulings. And so they argued that their proposal was adhering to that. And in fact, interestingly, the spokesperson said that while this definition, in her words, may be informed by science, but science cannot dictate where to draw the line between federal or state and or tribal waters.
I'm going to be talking to some people who oppose this coming up, but in general, how is the environment? I mean, this has been going on for the last 3 years, one way or the other. It's been coming around the mountain, as they say. How have they responded?
Really, they're responding in court. While, of course, they decry this, environmentalists see that their best shot is in challenging this for exactly some of the reasons we've just been talking about, that they think they stand a decent chance of arguing that the way the administration did this did not meet both kind of administrative federal requirements, just the way you're supposed to do a rule and pay attention to science, as well as just the underlying rule does not comply with what are the requirements under the Clean Air Act. So they see that as their shot for overturning what is now a final rule.
What are the what is the obligation of the agency to follow science?
Well, that's an excellent question. They absolutely have to do a scientific analysis And obviously that needs to inform what they're doing. It is a kind of complicated question because science does not have to be the determinative factor. That said, there are certain requirements about protecting the waters of the United States against pollution. And so I think it's really going to be that test. It's not, did you do the highest and most protective act, but did you do an adequate enough job? And in addition, there is this second thing we're talking about, which is that if the agency does tons of science and then the agency changes its mind and changes its approach and does nothing to repudiate the science that was done before, that's actually a process foul under administrative law.
So there'd been the science done before. That's what they were basing the regulations on heretofore and or previously, and now they should have an obligation to show other science that disputes that.
They have to at least show, other science or what was, again, done wrong. They also did a new economic analysis, so they can offer that, to kind of rebut it. But they have to give some justification. There's an idea under, our federal laws that you can't just totally reverse course if there's nothing in the record that justifies changing the policy.
What are the when you drop these kinds of regulations in this way, this stuff could be tied up in court for years. What happens to the regulations in the meantime? Are the changes stayed or what?
That is up to the federal courts. So it's a great point to make that there are certain instances where a federal judge may say so much is at stake that we're not allowing this law to take effect. But there are plenty of other instances where that we've seen where even though there might be real legal questions over whether a rulemaking is valid, the courts don't step in. They argue that, this just as the president was elected and each administration has the right to promote their policy agenda, these laws can go into effect. And again, so this water rule is in effect now. There's no injunction stopping it.
And anyways, the EPA already is underfunded. It already doesn't have enough time and resources to get to all of the questions of the day, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, what's interesting, people, again, obviously they look at the budget proposals we've seen coming under the Trump administration.
Uh-huh.
But really, when you look at starting in 2010, there was a bipartisan budget deal between the President Obama at the time and the Republican Congress. And that really took a bite out of EPA's budget. And it's never fully recovered from kind of a blow to its budget a decade ago, which has really, as you're saying, constrained some of its resources.
Yeah, it's really been a whipping boy. Now, of course, the EPA was established during the Nixon administration, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So is there any way to summarize what the impact of the EPA has been since the 70s?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's celebrating its 50-year anniversary this year.
Ironically, yeah.
Yeah, and I would say, I don't think anyone would question that, our air is significantly cleaner, our water is cleaner, the environment across the United States is better as a result of EPA policies. Both Republicans and Democrats, including the president himself, point to a lot of the progress that's been made. And the reason why there's not lead in gasoline and we have catalytic converters in our cars is because of rules championed by the EPA. And so that it has absolutely had a tremendous impact on this country.
Juliet Eilperin, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Juliet Eilperin is a reporter for The Washington Post. She covers the EPA. We are going to continue our conversation about plans. Well, not plans. It's a deal now that the U.S. EPA will revise and change how the federal government regulates streams and wetlands. It's a rule and change. Opponents have gone to court over this, but whether or not that means the rule will be stayed is still in play. We'll continue our conversation. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency last month announced plans to slash the number of waterways protected by the Clean Water Act. This week, President Trump sent Congress a proposed 2021 budget that underscores the reduced protections with big cuts to science, health, and environmental agencies. In a new report out today, the Union of Concerned Scientists warned that efforts to sideline science at the federal level could have severe consequences for children. The report is titled Endangering Generations: How the Trump Administration's Assault on Science is Harming Children's Health. Jenna Reed is a science and policy analyst in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's the lead author of the report. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks so much for having me.
President Trump has said making sure Americans have access to the cleanest air and cleanest water on the planet has been a top priority from day one. So he sees the road to these kind of protections differently than you do.
Absolutely. This administration has been undermining the science that informs many policy decisions in the past 3 years that it has been in office. We have been tracking what we have termed attacks on science that have occurred under this administration over the past 3 years, and found that there are over 120 different cases where this administration has failed to use the science, has failed to listen to its own scientists and science advisors, and the results of these decisions have meant that our air is not cleaner and our water is not any safer. And the findings of this report actually demonstrate how these decisions and failure to act on particular issues will actually have long-term health impacts on children.
I was just talking with Washington Post reporter about and asked her to kind of summarize what difference does it make that we're celebrating. I guess some aren't celebrating, but the EPA has been in business for 50 years this year. And what kind of evidence there is that it matters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the Environmental Protection Agency has been doing some really important work over the past half a century. They have, you know, ensured that that air pollution has actually gotten significantly less prevalent. Our waterways are significantly cleaner. All sorts of regulations have been put in place to protect us from chemicals and products that are going on the market. And without the Environmental Protection Agency, we wouldn't have all of these protections put in place to protect kids. One example of the things that EPA has done over its tenure is create a children's health office that specifically looks at these things. Working to make sure that the science supported getting lead out of gasoline because of the impacts of lead exposure, particularly on children. There's all sorts of protections that the EPA has been able to secure over the past 50 years, and the Trump administration has made, is really targeted a lot of those protections, and I think what we've seen is that the reason for targeting them and for having this really deregulatory agenda is to, appease the industry interests that have made their way into political appointees at the agencies, particularly EPA.
When it comes to children, did your report suggest at all that some children are more at risk than others?
Absolutely. These issues, we go into detail on 10 specific issues ranging from toxics exposure to consumer product safety to some of the impacts on rolling back the USDA's food security programs. And, while all of these rollbacks or weakening of standards impact all kids and all families across the country, they are particularly egregious for communities of color and low-income communities who are already experiencing, the chemical burden in this country and already experiencing many inequities that are making their lives more challenging.
When I was talking to the Washington Post reporter, she said that the cuts that they're looking at, or the regulation rollbacks that they're looking, the rollbacks go far beyond the Obama administration rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just rollbacks. What we're seeing at the EPA particularly is a lack of enforcement of rules that are on the books. So,
which is always an issue because there's, yes. You know, I mean, you know, that they're short-staffed and they're low, you know, the funding's always been skimpy.
Right, but there's been a particular, you know, purge of scientists at the agency. Morale is pretty low. There's been political interference that has really been, you know, changing the way that scientists are, you know, having an opportunity to really interact with decision making. And all of those things have led to a situation at the agency, EPA and others, where, you know, the science is not informing policies, and we are paying the price for that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is the lead science and policy analyst for the Center for Science and Democracy, Jenna Reed. She is also the lead author of a new report out from the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's titled Endangering Generations, How the Trump Administration's Assault on Science is Harming Children's Health. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Booth, who is making a case for or questioning what we actually mean by protecting wetlands. He says, I understand the value of wetlands, but protecting wetlands could be overdone, right? I'd remind folks that in the first half of the 19th century, maybe longer, Ohio had a huge problem with malaria, which was only alleviated as improved drainage of farmland occurred. Any comments about that?
You know, I'm not particularly an expert on that example that he brought up, but I would like to speak to the fact that the agency's own science advisors have pushed back against the changes to the definition of wetlands under the new WOTUS rule because they don't take into consideration all of the science that supports the hydrogeology of wetlands, changing the definition of wetlands so that now 50% of our nation's wetlands are no longer considered waterways is really an oversight of the science. And what it does is it will have impacts on the way that our, the wetlands are able to, stay clean and provide all of the many benefits that they provide to our communities and economic benefits, especially with rising temperatures and a changing climate. Wetlands are a really important hurricane and rising sea buffer. And, you know, as we consider fewer and fewer of them to be bodies of water that we should protect, we're only going to be hurting ourselves in the long run.
I wanted to talk about, you know, the question of whether the EPA administrators need to use science and listen to scientists and advisors. What do we know? Is there a legal obligation for them to do so?
There is in certain regulations. You know, it's really important that in order to make good decisions at the agency level, we need to listen to the evidence. And this is true for, you know, in our daily lives as well. We need to make sure that we have all of the evidence before we make good decisions. And so science is a tool that we use to understand the impacts and trade-offs of what happens in our communities. And the agency really needs to have the evidence on the table as it makes decisions and listen to its scientists and science advisors to make sure those decisions are really protecting public health. Because at the end of the day, the Environmental Protection Agency and other agencies are you know, funded by taxpayers and are supposed to protect us and the environment. That's their mission. So we need to make sure that they're using the science to meet that mission and keep us safe.
The Trump administration described its decision or explained part of, in a way, its decision to reduce federal government regulations protecting streams and wetlands by saying it's creating more clarity. That even Juliet Eilprin from The Washington Post said that Yeah, I mean, the rules and regulations, not just with EPA, but with Health and Human Services, it can become a quagmire. There's so much, you know, with court rulings and just, every, you know, changing administrations every 8 years or so. Mm-hmm. It's no one really understands what to do.
Right. You know, I think that this is an issue in any under any administration. But what this administration is doing is taking science out of the equation and making decisions that are really pretty arbitrary and don't have our best interests in mind. You know, there's a lot of evidence of all of the ways in which industry interests are prioritized over public health at the EPA right now. There are many different individuals who have political appointee positions at the agency who have come right from the industries that the agency actually regulates. So there's massive conflicts of interest, and the bottom line is that the way in which industry has infiltrated this administration is making for decisions that aren't based in the science, that are putting our health and our children's health in immediate danger.
Your organization has put out a storybook that illustrates these issues. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we, along with the report, we released a storybook called Breathe in the Smog, Drink in the Lead, a grim, scary tale for people who care about kids. And this is a storybook that is meant to be read for kids, not to them. It's for an adult audience. And what it does is really illustrates the issues that we have talked about in the report, you know, how the Trump administration has rolled back or weakened many different environmental health standards, how, you know, other agencies, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, have, you know, also taken steps to cut benefits or programs that would help children's health. So we wanted to really break through all of the noise with this theme that we think really would speak to a large audience of people, which is that when people in power sideline science, kids are harmed. And we hope that this book, you know, which tells the story through verses, rhyming verses and pictures, can be an entry point to spark a bigger discussion about these harms.
I wrote probably 25 years ago, I kind of predicted that things would be different because of the way we're educating children with science, and they're actually more sophisticated than ever before about the environment. I mean, I look at, you know, the involvement of young people recently protesting the environment, you know, how governments are treating the environment. What about that? Do kids play a role in any of this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have been so inspired by all of the children that have been speaking up and, you know, raising their voices and developing and building power in their communities to speak up about issues like climate change, which adults and our generation has largely failed to take action on to ensure that they have safe and healthy futures. And, you know, the burden shouldn't be on them to speak up and make change, but, you know, they feel as if they must. And so we need to stand with them. And, you know, we really, you know, climate change is one of the issues that we talk about in the report. The Trump administration has been rolling back, you know, emission standards, has pulled or taken steps to pull us out of the Paris Agreement, and has largely denied the impacts of climate change. And, you know, we're seeing the effects of climate change already in communities across the country that are experiencing, you know, increased flooding, higher temperatures. You know, children are already suffering, especially communities of color and low-income communities, and it's only going to get worse. We need change. We need action. So we need to follow the lead of the youth movement that has really been gaining a lot of traction, and we hope that our report will help kind of generate, you know, the interest in this issue, and help parents understand how incredibly important it is for them to also get involved, to hold decision makers accountable for preserving children's futures.
Let's see, Grant in Columbus, you're on the air with Jenna Reed. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ann. I like everything that Jenna's saying. I appreciate it. I called in with you earlier this year when you were at the State Fair discussing wetlands and the need for them. Just a little levity. I'm fortunate to work for an EV firm, and I come from big industry. Things, even though Trump is pulling away from funding and cutting the EPA, just to let you guys know, everyone is working on as much tech and improvements as possible. And after Obama changed some things, everyone's already kind of going in that trajectory, even though Trump's, you know, cutting things, unless you're talking about, you know, coal, in my opinion. All of us young people are working on the best things that we can to, you know, move to hydrogen technology, for now batteries. It's coming, but I'll jump off the air. Appreciate it, guys. Thank you,
okay.
Ladies. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Grant. So, Jenna Reed, I guess Grant's saying private industry gets it, and they don't want to pollute the world. They're working on the technologies to change things. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think that's it's a good point. There are lots of companies across the country that are stepping up and taking responsibility for, the scientific fact that our climate is changing, and, you know, making up for it in innovation and technology that will help make improvements. But there are some companies that are not doing the same. And the whole point of having a federal government and agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency is to hold those industries accountable. It's really important that industries are stepping up, but we need an agency like the EPA and other agencies of the government to have the tools and the enforcement power to hold companies accountable and make sure that the regulations that are put in place are pushing those companies to have better technologies to prevent, you know, chemical disasters, or to ensure that companies are thinking about climate change when they're developing their plans. I think it's a really excellent point, but I think those two things go hand in hand.
Jenna Reed, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Jenna Reed is the lead science and policy analyst in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's the lead author of a new report is out today. It's titled Endangering Generations, How the Trump Administration's Assault on Science is Harming Children's Health. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at what the changing regulations at the U.S. EPA could mean for something like the Big Darby Creek here in central Ohio. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Big Darby Creek extends 83 miles. It stretches from the Champaign-Union County line southeast to the Battelle-Darby Creek Metro Park in western Franklin County. It is home to 44 freshwater mussel and more than 100 fish species. The biggest threat to the waterway has been development, and in 2006, several local governments signed onto an accord designed to limit development on the eastern part of the watershed. A new U.S. EPA rule change that cuts protections for waterways, though, could make it easier to develop on the western side of the watershed. Vincent Messerly is the president of the Stream and Wetlands Foundation. He works with the public and developers to find ways to protect and restore wetlands with an eye toward economic development. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Anthony Sasson is a senior research associate at the Midwest Biodiversity Institute in Hilliard. He's a member of the Darby Creek Association. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Ann.
Anthony, we hear about Darby Creek all the time. I mean, it's been had headlines in the newspaper for decades now in terms of protecting it. Why is Darby Creek so important?
Well, it's a state and national scenic river. It was deemed those back in the 80s and 90s, and it's an exceptional stream. Its key feature is the biodiversity that is outstanding. It's got a lot of rare endangered fish and mussel species, and it received very high scores from Ohio EPA in the most recent survey. So it just has a lot that has remained that represents Ohio before settlement, and it is endangered.
For people who are listening who maybe don't understand, why is diversity important? What difference does it make?
Well, it gives us, like I said, a picture of what Ohio has in terms of its wildlife. All those fish that are in Big Darby Creek that are not found in most streams in Ohio represent something that we could treasure. It gives us a place for recreation and sort of renewal of the spirit. If you get a chance to be out there in one of the metro parks that are along the creek, it's a very scenic area that is treasured by a lot of Ohioans.
And that 2006 accord, that was for the eastern side of the Darby Creek watershed, right?
It applies to Franklin County only, the
okay.
10 jurisdictions in Franklin County, the county, the townships, and municipalities like Columbus and Hilliard.
That mostly had to do with development, right?
Yes, it had to do with development because in the 1990s it was recognized there was a large influx of development into the watershed, and people understood that stormwater from development was a big impact on streams. So the accord was established to help fend at least some of that off.
Vincent Messerly, everybody wants to live near a pretty river, pretty stream. This is the kind of place where people want to live. That's why everybody wants to develop over there. Plus, there's a lot of land that's been protected or hasn't been developed because of the rules and regulations surrounding Big Darby Creek. How do you approach development like that? And what do you do to facilitate development that can be in the spirit of what Anthony Sasson is saying?
Well, the accord is a big first step for the community. But it's obviously very tricky. How do you retain the integrity of the watershed and still provide those living spaces that people so strongly desire? And it's a beautiful area. Anthony's correct. And it's a stream that has so many rare and endangered mussels and fish. And so how do you do that without impinging upon those qualities and attributes? The Darby Accord is a good start. It's something that can be improved upon. But, you know, understanding that folks that do land development are very sensitive to those issues, and they try to work within the confines of the accord. But the accord's not perfect. And as you pointed out, it only addresses the areas in Franklin County on the east side of the Darby River or the Darby Creek. Nothing on the west side of the stream or out in Madison County and Union County. And so there are things that could be improved. I think largely most developers are very sensitive to that and believe and value in those attributes. And that's what makes that area highly sought after by folks that want to live there.
Anthony, what of these new regulation changes at the federal level? Do they have any impact on the likes of Big Darby Creek?
Hopefully not. One of the things that's important is the small streams that this new federal rule would change protection for. It would eliminate what's protection for what are called ephemeral streams, or those streams that flow for a relatively short period of time. So those streams are everywhere in Ohio. There's thousands of miles of those and probably hundreds of these small streams in the Big Darby watershed. So those should be protected. And the federal rule proposes to eliminate those from federal oversight. And we still have, it's very important that we still have state oversight, and we do. It's defined in state law, and we hope that nothing changes to that effect. So the state still has jurisdiction over these streams.
What is tougher to deal with, Vincent Messerly, state regulations? And when I say tougher to deal with, I mean, what makes more sense, state regulations or federal regulations at this point?
Oh, boy, that's not an easy question to answer. Mm-hmm. You know, the state and federal rules are both very important, and both can be written poorly and enforced poorly. So to try to divine which one is more important over the other would be really difficult for anybody to do. But in Ohio,
but it looks like the federal government's saying, leave it to the states.
Yeah, they are. And particularly as Anthony was talking about ephemeral streams, and keep in mind, these are streams that run with water immediately after a rainfall event or snow melt. So these are typically very small. The new Waters of the United States definition would not provide coverage for those. But understanding prior to 2015, it really didn't afford coverage as well either. You get a lot of inconsistencies in the enforcement effort, and that was one of the clarifications that was needed in the 2015 rule that was attempted. And, of course, in the new rule, it clarifies it in saying that they're not. So it's clearly an area of contention. And by the federal Waters of the United States definition, removing them clearly, and of course, I expect challenges will be made to that proposed rule, it does present a bright line. And it does then rely on the states and across the country to enforce those policies and to develop their own policies. And I think in Ohio, there's going to be clarification needed. The existing state law does address the definition of what are waters of the state of Ohio, but what it does not address just yet is what is required for compensatory mitigation. When is a permit going to be required? The state law right now, while it does define non-jurisdictional, federal jurisdictional wetlands in a very specific policy for addressing state wetlands, there is not a complementary policy in place to address state waters that might include ephemeral streams.
What do you think, Anthony Sasson?
Well, I think Vince is right. It's going to be unclear how the state will handle this. The state has standards that they have to meet for streams and wetlands. And especially for these small streams, it's going to be a question of if the federal government, in this case, the Army Corps of Engineers, is the one who actually oversees the permit system for streams and wetlands, how will the state then step in and determine how the system is going to work if the Army Corps of Engineers is not the permitter of these small streams, the impacts on these small streams?
Long-term, well, I guess short-term and long-term, what is your sense about the funding at the federal level? Now, Congress has not approved the funding cuts that the Trump administration has asked for in the last few years. But when the regulations are cut, and you know, it's a whole different ball game. And I'm just wondering about the long-term impact. How do you catch up? Anthony?
Well, US EPA is the one that's working on defining what a small ephemeral stream is right now. Ohio has more or less defined that in the past in some technical manuals that they've written. And if the state of Ohio can actually step up and do that, then we might have a clear definition of what an ephemeral stream is. I think if the proposed federal budget cut might go through for US EPA, which mm-hmm. is about a quarter of their budget,
right,
if I read it right, mm-hmm. then you know, that could be affected. But because this is a high-profile item, maybe they would work on this and not cut that part of the budget as much.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Brad. He writes, I think like everything else the Trump administration has done, there is a strong philosophy behind the people Trump puts in charge of the departments. The goal in every situation is to tear down barriers to allowing businesses to run free, plundering the environment, and doing other things that were once considered completely wrong and unethical. And Vincent Messerly, as a kind of a go-between the environmental community and the development community, whether it's, you know, utilities, as you mentioned earlier before we went on there, hospitals, you know, you gave me a litany of organizations of concerns that you might represent at any given time. What's your sense about how they regard the environment these days?
By they, you're talking about the current administration.
Well, the current administration, but they're saying that he's saying that the people that the president puts in charge of something like the EPA suggests that the goal is to tear down barriers to allowing businesses to run free.
Yeah, and I guess I tend to shy away from becoming a political choosing sides, understanding that we serve environmental interest and economic development interest, and we're kind of a Switzerland in a way.
And I understand that.
So, you know, as we look at the policies, clearly, there's been a long ongoing difficulty with the Waters of the United States definition, you know, from Supreme Court cases from the 80s all the way up until just in the last couple of years. It's just and the agencies, US EPA, as well as the Corps of Engineers, have been lectured by the Supreme Court on a number of occasions to say, guys, look, you got to come up with a better definition and better policy because we can't continue to regulate by the Supreme Court. And so I think it's an important step. The Obama administration tried to take that in 2015. This is another bite at the apple. It's a little different take, obviously. But, you know, I think, you know, looking at what they're trying to do is leave a lot of that decision making to the states. And I'm sure you're going to talk to a lot of different people that will give you that, you know, that's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also just as many fans of the idea of being local rule and the state of Ohio making their own decisions and making their own choices. You know, I go back to 2001, the Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County, or the Swank decision, was really paramount in the state of Ohio back then. Once the Supreme Court decided that an area would not be Waters of the United States, Governor Taft at the time enacted emergency policy. The state legislature reacted quickly within 90 days. The first tour of duty for Speaker Householder back in 2001. He brought the stakeholders, put you know, one side in one room, the other side in the other room, and they negotiated a policy. And I still believe to this day it's the most effective, most robust isolated wetland policy in the country. And there's no reason why the state of Ohio couldn't roll its sleeves up and do the same thing again.
What do you think, Anthony Sesson?
Well, I think that it would be a bad idea for Ohio to roll back to 2001 or before. I mean, what Vince just said, that we've adopted a state isolated wetlands policy, which is a good one.
Yeah,
I agree.
And I'm not saying go back to 2001, Anthony. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying what you said would be doing that.
Yeah.
But I don't hope that anybody suggests that or goes forward with that in the General Assembly. I think with ephemeral streams that we should move forward. We've invested a huge amount of money in H2 Ohio and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative in the state. And so using those funds to protect small streams and wetlands is a good idea. And I don't think we're going to go back. I don't want to misinterpret or misstate what Ben said.
Yeah. I guess what I'd like to see is can the state address the ephemeral streams in a similar manner? Can we develop policy that works for Ohioans, that helps facilitate a permitting program and a regulatory program that works for Ohioans? But it is death by a thousand cuts if you look across the country. You know, if every state has to take on the same initiative, that's going to be a real challenge.
Not every state is as well prepared to do
correct.
That. Yeah. Vincent Messerly, president of the Stream and Wetlands Foundation, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Anne.
And Anthony Sesson, senior research associate at the Midwest Biodiversity Institute and a member of the Darby Creek Association, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
This is it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening. This is on 89.7 NPR News.